It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 47 degrees under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they are showing north winds at 8 miles per hour, and they are up to 7 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for showers for today and tonight and until tomorrow morning at least, followed by rain after 10 a.m. tomorrow. Northeast winds to 10, turning to the north tonight. High near 48 today, overnight low of 43 tonight. Coming up on the Midday Report, our congressional delegation is standing with Israel. Work is wrapped up for the season on the Pretty Rocks Bridge. And members of the state's Energy Security Task Force ran into a bit of criticism during a public hearing on Tuesday. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Israeli military says its ground troops in Gaza have freed a soldier who was held hostage there. It's the first known successful military operation to rescue a hostage in Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Israel says its ground troops rescued Private Ori Megidish in an overnight mission. That rescue mission came as Israel continued with a ground incursion and heavy bombardment in Gaza City that Palestinian health officials say caused heavy casualties. The soldier was taken hostage by Hamas on October 7th, the day nearly 2,000 attackers stormed southern Israel, killing about 1,400 people and taking hundreds hostage. Four other female civilians were released by Hamas in recent weeks in what it called humanitarian gestures. Israel says 238 people are still being held hostage in Gaza. Hamas released a video with three Israeli hostages calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to set free Palestinian prisoners in exchange for their release. As with any hostage video, it's unclear if they were coerced. Netanyahu's office called it cruel psychological propaganda. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The United Auto Workers have reached a tentative agreement with a final holdout, General Motors, potentially ending a month-and-a-half-old strike against GM, Ford, and Stellantis. President Biden says the agreements ensure the iconic Big Three can still lead the world in innovation while supporting worker power from the middle out and the bottom up.
These record agreements reward auto workers who gave up much to keep the industry working and going during the financial crisis more than a decade ago.
The tentative contracts still need to be individually ratified by UAW's members at the three companies. A Colorado court will determine if former President Donald Trump should be dropped from the state's 2024 presidential ballot over his role in the 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. Today, Trump's attorney argued his client should not be held responsible for his supporters' actions. A woman in Jackson, Mississippi, seeking to exhume the remains of her son who was run over by an off-duty police officer. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports Jackson police failed to notify the family of his death and buried him at jailhouse Paupers Field.
Betterstein Wade says she reported her 37-year-old son Dexter missing and kept following up with police but didn't learn what happened for more than 5 months.
What kind of system do we work upon? Do we have a system that works for us?
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump represents the family. He says they will seek an independent autopsy and give Dexter Wade a proper burial.
And make sure he has a headstone and not a pole with a number on it and a pauper's graveyard.
The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Antar Lumumba, says the failure was not malicious, but a lack of communication between police and the coroner. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. With Israeli hostages still in captivity and the death toll in Gaza rising, Alaska's congressional delegation is staying in Israel's corner. Congresswoman Mary Peltola voted last week for a House resolution condemning the Hamas attack and backing Israel's right to defend itself. It passed overwhelmingly, with only a handful of Democrats and one Republican voting no. The U.S. Senate unanimously passed a similar resolution, and Senator Dan Sullivan has been especially outspoken. He and other senators were in Tel Aviv Sunday and held a press conference.
This is a very sobering day, meeting with the families of the hostages, seeing videos that I actually think the whole world should see, of the just severe brutality and viciousness and evil.
He was speaking of the October 7th Hamas attack, which killed more than 1,400 people in Israel, most of them civilians. Israel has stepped up its bombardment of Gaza, killing thousands as it attempts to abolish Hamas. Sullivan says the difference is that Hamas intended to kill civilians.
There's no moral equivalence. Every civilian death in a war is horrible. But what we're seeing and what we saw with regard to Hamas was an attempt to actually make more civilian deaths as bloody and vicious as possible.
The Hamas-run Ministry of Health says more than 7,000 people have been killed in Gaza, but the U.S. says it can't verify that number. More than 120 countries voted Friday for a United Nations resolution seeking a humanitarian ceasefire. The United States, Israel, and a dozen or so other countries voted no. Members of the state's Energy Security Task Force ran into a buzzsaw of criticism during a public hearing last Tuesday on Governor Mike Dunleavy's plan that favors natural gas and includes a mandate to sharply cut the cost of electricity. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Tuesday's public hearing on the task force's latest draft of a statewide energy master plan included criticism by environmentally minded Alaskans like Rebecca Siegel of Fairbanks, who says the plan has evolved into a sales pitch for a liquid natural gas pipeline instead of a blueprint for transitioning to alternative energy sources like wind, solar, and hydro.
My big concern about this report is the emphasis on the AK LNG project and the North Slope natural gas bullet line.
The AK LNG line is estimated to cost more than $40 billion, and the smaller bullet line to South Central likely would cost about $9 billion. Siegel says building either of those gas lines wouldn't lower the cost of heating homes and businesses, at least in the short term.
This long-term lock-in is more than doubling down on fossil fuels and will absolutely divert Alaska from diversifying electricity generation at a time when we simply cannot afford that distraction.
Others who spoke during the public hearing, including some who favored continued use of fossil fuels, focused on what they said were faulty economic assumptions in the most recent draft plan issued October 20th.
The measures outlined in the master plan will neither lower the cost nor add energy security for Alaskans due to the Cook Inlet being shut down and available resources like coal being ignored.
Ken Huckabee, who lives in Wasilla, says he especially dislikes using federal funding from legislation passed by Congress in 2021 and 22 that was intended to reinvigorate the economy after the pandemic nearly brought it to its knees.
This master plan appears to be an implementation plan of the Green New Deal, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, to seek the printed money and inflation-causing federal control policies contained in the Infrastructure and Jobs Act.
Cassie Andrews pointed to a lack of due diligence on the plan's claims and assumptions.
The entire premise of this report is to provide information on how Alaska will get to 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and it is completely devoid of cost analysis, cost comparisons, risk analysis, or any analysis, really.
Provisions of the plan call for conveying utility assets like power transmission lines and battery storage systems to the Alaska Energy Authority to enable better coordination of rail belt electricity transmission. But Chugach Electric Vice President and General Counsel Matthew Clarkson expressed doubts about that.
Chugach is not in a position to be able to affirmatively support such a recommendation, it would likely oppose any unprecedented state action to condemn its private utility business assets for such a purpose.
Clarkson commended Governor Mike Dunleavy for proposing the plan and task force members for their deep dive study on what he called, quote, a truncated timeline. That's a reference to Dunleavy's administrative order issued in March that requires the task force to submit a final plan by December 1st. The task force's next meeting is Tuesday in Anchorage. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Human-caused climate change is accelerating the thaw of permafrost in the Arctic. That thaw causes numerous problems, from eroding coastlines and crumbling roads and infrastructure to increased carbon dioxide and methane release. But the new threat is that's emerging from the thaw, rusting rivers. In the Brooks Range, numerous rivers and streams are turning orange and releasing water with unusually high metal concentrations, which is threatening aquatic life and drinking water. As KOTC's Desiree Hagen reports, this surprising phenomenon has caught the attention of scientists.
Patrick Sullivan is an ecologist with the University of Alaska Anchorage. He has spent the last two decades studying vegetation in the Northwest Arctic. In that time, he's witnessed many ecological changes. But none of it, he says, compared to a scene Sullivan encountered back in 2019.
It's really apocalyptic to see. I mean, it looks burned. You know, it looks like it was like somebody poured gasoline all over the tundra and then lit a fire and burned off all the vegetation and then released some sort of like orange goo to trickle down through.
The apocalyptic landscape that Sullivan describes is from acid seeps, mostly along remote tundra hillsides. The acidic water flows down the hillsides and into streams, killing much of the vegetation in its path. Sullivan says acid seeps make the stream water cloudy and in many cases distinctively orange-colored. He says the orange color is caused by high iron concentrations in the water. But while iron is the most visible metal in the affected areas, it may not be the most problematic. The rusting rivers generally have high concentrations of more toxic metals, like copper and aluminum. Sullivan and his research team were shocked by findings on their portable water quality sensors.
Quickly discovered that it has like a pH of 2 and an electrical conductivity of like 5,000, and so it's completely loaded with metals.
Sullivan says the high metal concentrations are a threat to fish.
I think probably the greatest concern for human health and subsistence resources is really, you know, the impact that this might be having on salmon, Dolly Varden, grayling, the fish that are in these streams. Yeah, many of those metals have known toxic effects on fish.
Sullivan says acidic water has been documented in at least 30 rivers and streams in the Brooks Range. He worked with a group of scientists this summer, including Roman Dial from Alaska Pacific University, to study its impact on several small creeks that feed into larger rivers, like the Salmon and Kobuk Rivers. Sullivan and other researchers looking at what he calls rusting rivers believes it's primarily caused by sulfide-rich material in the bedrock of watersheds.
What we think is happening is that as the permafrost thaws, these sulfide minerals are being exposed to oxygen for the first time in like a very long time, like geologic type timescales. When these sulfide minerals are exposed to oxygen in water, they produce sulfuric acid.
Scientists estimate that 75% of the Earth's near-surface permafrost will be gone by the end of the century. And as the Arctic warms, Sullivan says, the rusting rivers phenomenon is a massive surprise to the scientific community.
We had been anticipating that the proliferation of shrubs, the northward advance of the tree line, the thawing of permafrost, and the release of CO2 and methane associated with that. But I don't think that anyone anticipated that this would happen.
Sullivan says it's likely that this process has happened previously in the distant past, but that it probably hasn't happened at anywhere near the rate that it is now in our rapidly warming climate.
The rate of warming that we're, you know, basically imposing on these landscapes is far greater than anything they've experienced historically.
Sullivan says there's still a lot of research to do on the topic. He hopes to return to the Brooks Range next summer with a team of scientists to get a better sense of which currently clear running streams may be vulnerable to rusting in the near future. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
Work has wrapped up for the season on construction of a bridge over a slumping section of the road into Denali National Park. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, efforts were focused on preparing the site and the readying and staging of equipment and bridge components for the actual construction work in 2024.
The new bridge will span a landslide in an area known as Pretty Rocks, about halfway out the 92-mile Denali National Park Road, where a melting rock glacier has made the road impassable since 2021. Park engineer Steve Mant says this summer's work included construction of a crew camp at mile 27, as well as staging areas closer to the bridge site where the narrow road runs along a mountainside.
You know, the work that they actually did at the project site this year was pretty much limited to excavation activities and then constructing a temporary road from the east side of the landslide to the west side of the landslide.
The temporary track skirts slightly south of where the slide is carved away an over 450-foot stretch of Park Road, 70 feet deep. Mant says the Pioneer Road provides a way to get earth-moving equipment across the landslide.
Because of the way the road alignment works out at the west end of the future bridge, there's just a bunch of that hillside that they have to take out. So, getting equipment over to conduct that excavation was really the primary purpose of needing that road this year.
Mant says a crane was also moved across in anticipation of actual bridge construction work starting next season, including the installation of large abutment blocks.
Huge, 52 feet long, 15 feet wide, 13 sections per end of the bridge, and those sections were actually built in Anchorage. So that was one of the things that happened this year.
Mant emphasizes how much behind-the-scenes work is required given the short construction season.
The planning to make sure you're going to have everything that you need to maximize the amount of work you can get done during that season, it's really a huge part of the work. And, the good news is, a lot of that stuff's done now, and there's going to be a lot of on-site work that's going to occur in, the 2024 season that, you're really going to see changes. And then, what will be most dramatic is, of course, in 2025 when a bridge is set up out there and then put into place.
Mant says the target date for completion of the 475-foot-long steel truss bridge is July 2026. The cost of the bridge has yet to be finalized, but a press release from project contractor Granite Construction put it at $95.6 million as of early October, with some awards still forthcoming. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
There was almost no debate on more than two dozen resolutions proposed this year during the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. As KYUK's Emily Schwing reports, it's a noticeable departure from previous years when debate over issues including subsistence fishing and climate change was heated and contentious.
This year, AFN members were aligned on a resolution that calls for immediate congressional action to permanently protect subsistence hunting and fishing in the state's navigable waters. The proposal focuses on indigenous rights, but Myra Nanning, a delegate representing Hooper Bay's Sea Lion Corporation, proposed an amendment to include the word Aboriginal in resolution language.
The reason why we're adding Aboriginal is because back in 1997, we negotiated the Migratory Bird Treaty, and we tried to use indigenous. The people that we negotiated with said indigenous is all-inclusive of everyone that lives in rural Alaska, but we were talking about Alaska Native Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights.
AFN also unanimously passed a resolution in favor of Alaska's ranked choice voting process. Matthew Nikolai, who's originally from Gweethluk, spoke in opposition of Alaskans for Honest Elections, an initiative working to repeal Alaska's ranked choice voting system.
It's very important our Native people stand up and show up to the elections to fight this, saying it's honest and fair. It's not. So, Madam Chair, with unanimous consent, I do hope this resolution passes. Thank you.
A resolution promoting a health initiative that leverages the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race to increase awareness around health and well-being wasn't considered. It was submitted after a deadline, and AFN members declined a motion to suspend the rules to include it in proceedings. Regional caucuses that opposed moving that resolution forward said they wanted to maintain the integrity of the parliamentary procedures AFN follows. In prior years, rule suspensions have caused tension among AFN members. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
The United Auto Workers Union has reached tentative agreements with all three of Detroit's big automakers. I'm Novosoffo with a Marketplace Minute. GM was the last. The UAW reached a deal with the automaker this morning. Stellantis over the weekend, Ford last week. Strikes at the Big Three started September 15, and they officially end if workers ratify the agreements. Starting Wednesday, the government will hand over distribution of COVID antiviral treatments to the commercial health insurance market, just as it has with COVID vaccines. Officials expect most people will retain access at little or no cost. McDonald's today reported that revenues soared 14% in the 3 months ending in September. That was thanks to sales promotions. Profits totaled more than $2 billion. I'm Novosoffo with a Marketplace Minute.
Immerse yourselves in a journey into the unknown as we unveil a radio play that will send shivers down your spine. In a world where reality and imagination collide, where secrets lurk behind every curtain, that thing in the window will keep you on the edge of your seat. Meet Mr. Ames, an ordinary man with an extraordinary obsession. He's convinced that a chilling presence haunts the window across the street. Is it a ghostly apparition, a twisted reality, or just a product of his overactive imagination? Brace yourself, dear listeners, for a chilling radio drama that will grip your imagination. Join us on KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM at 8 p.m. and KODK Kodiak 90.1 at 9 p.m. to experience That Thing in the Window, penned by Lucille Fletcher. Produced and performed by Kodiak Stagecraft. It's a mystery you won't want to miss.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 30th day of October, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 9:18. It will set again at 6:27. That will give us 9 hours and 9 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 42 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 60 degrees, set in 1946. And our record low was 12 degrees, set in 1976. It's currently 47 degrees in Kodiak under overcast skies. They are up to 7 miles of visibility out at the airport. And they have wind speeds from the north at 8 miles per hour. The Weather Service is calling for showers for the rest of the afternoon and tonight until about 11 a.m. tomorrow morning, when rain is expected to begin. Mostly cloudy skies through the period. High near 48 today, overnight low about 43 tonight, with northeast winds to 10, turning to the north this evening. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 3:14 this afternoon. That will be 10.6 feet here on the east side, followed by a low tide at 9:57 tonight, call it 10 p.m. That will be a big minus tide, minus 1.5 feet, if you are a tide pooler or have anything that might get hung up on a piling. Over on the west side, Your high tide will happen at 3:46 this afternoon and be 16.6 feet, followed by a low tide at 10:29 p.m. of minus 2.8 feet in Larsen Bay. Mariners, here's your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tomorrow. Northeast winds to 20 knots for today and tonight with seas to 9 feet. Northeast 25 tomorrow with 7-foot seas. And Tuesday night through Wednesday, northeast 30, seas to 9 feet again. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tomorrow. No, just for tomorrow, rather. Northeast 20 for today and tonight in the Shelikof with 5-foot seas. Northeast 30 tomorrow with 8-foot seas. And northeast 35 tomorrow night with seas coming up to 11 feet. Don't forget that thing in the window. That's going on at 8 p.m. on KMXT and on KODK at 9 p.m. That thing in the window. Real stadium, real drama for Halloween. Speaking of Halloween, that's tomorrow. Drive carefully. Remember, between 3:30 and 5 o'clock is the downtown trick-or-treating time. There will be lots of kids downtown trick-or-treating at that time, especially in that whole downtown area around the new building. Look for crossing guards and kids later on in neighborhoods, too, doing some more trick-or-treating. Meetings coming up in the Kodiak Island Borough include at 3 p.m. this afternoon, the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room. Again, that's at 3 p.m. For tomorrow, the Joint Building Code Review Committee is having their regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room at 3 p.m. On Wednesday, the Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting in the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center Conference Room at 5:15 p.m. And on Thursday, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having their regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All meetings are open to the public, and meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough's website. Contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. Kodiak Elders Coffee Tea Hour is happening again on Wednesday. That goes on between 10:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. at the Koniag Conference Area over on 194 Alamac Drive on Near Island. Transportation is available for beneficiaries. For more information or to arrange a ride, please contact Elder Services at 907-486-7352. And Friday is the First Friday Art Walk. And you can see art at all kinds of different places, including Double Shovel Cider. They will be featuring Tyler Jackson's art, Kodiak History Museum, featuring an exhibit, Objects Uncovered. The Lutik Museum is partnering with the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge Visitor Center, so there are things in both those places. And the Kodiak Arts Council has their 11th Annual Artist Trading Card Show going on. Also, the Kodiak Harvest Food Co-op, stop in there, as well as the Harborside Flyby, so a big First Friday art walk this Friday. Student creative writing submissions for Understory are open to UAA students taking a minimum of 3 credits with the University of Alaska system. Submissions close on Friday, December 1st. Guidelines for submissions are available at Understory Submissions, that's all one word, understorysubmissions@gmail.com. Scuttlebutt continues to happen on Tuesdays, I believe. It's a galley tables workshop for youth. It's a free weekly storytelling workshop for students in grades 9 through 12. They practice building and sharing stories with the help of experienced storytellers. That's Tuesdays, which is tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library's Craft Room. And don't forget to start preparing. The Kodiak Harbor Lights Festival and Boat Parade will be happening Saturday, December 16th this year, 5 to 9 p.m., and the St. Paul and St. Herman harbors. Join your friends and neighbors Saturday, December 16th to watch the Kodiak fleet decorated with holiday lights parade through Near Island Channel. Boats will rendezvous at 6 p.m. north of Near Island Bridge and proceed south through the channel to Pier 2 in the outer harbor. If there are high winds, the public is encouraged to walk the floats to see the decorated boats. Always a good idea anyway.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.